Hey, BAI Lover. Imagine a BAI PR team that every week would place articles in the left media about BAI. Or a team that creates an Each One, Reach One promo campaign to increase our membership. Or a team that reaches out for grants and major donors. We can do it, but we need a real infusion of people power, a grassroots volunteer effort. A key person in all of this would be a volunteer coordinator. So this is a call for volunteer coordinator. If you can volunteer 10 to 20 hours a week, have a vision, can recruit volunteers, can communicate effectively, and want to expand BAI's reach, then call at 212-209-2870. To apply for volunteer coordinator, call 209-2870 or email at volunteers@wbai.org. Thanks so much.
The ice is gonna break.
How does it feel?
It feels like times have changed.
To be present, to be here, it is always appropriate to be here, to contemplate. If you ever happen to be someplace and you contemplate, I'm not here, where are you? So in this moment, be here. Be here, wherever here happens to be. In this day and time, we have gathered together to contemplate, to dialogue this that is called...
Night shift again.
I'll be damn late.
Now, where are my people? talking about it, and I have no idea. I have no idea. I have no idea why I'm here. I don't know what I'm doing, you know, talking about this. I saw something, they saw something. There was a lot of light. That's all I remember.
Thank you. are tuned to listener-sponsored radio, and this is Night Shift. And I am here once again with the famed Dr. Kelly Elizabeth Wright, and who is what is your doctorate in? Is it in linguistics? Is it, what is it exactly?
Evening. Yes, it is in linguistics.
Doctor of Linguistics. Well, you're the first one I met, except for, now, I was thinking earlier about how we met, and or how we were introduced, and that was with Ben.
Yeah, Ben Zimmer.
So, I just want to say good evening to everyone, and we have a very special show planned. I have a very special topic that is, well, let's just say, goes along with a very special co-host, and you're going to, every time we do a show, we talk about language. Every time I do a show with Dr. Kelly Wright, we do talk about language. But one of the things I love is that I'm always finding out something else about language. I'm finding out something else that either I kind of knew, I kind of thought of, I wondered about, or a lot of times things that I just took for granted. And I never realized exactly just how deep or how powerful it goes. And so the topic, and if you don't know what this is here at the top of the show, which is, it's now 10:16, and that's a Mondegreen. The title of the show is Mondegreens and the Instinct of Language. So I want you to think about that for a second.
Some kind of moment.
First thing you must be wondering is exactly what is a Mondegreen? Now, I could read the definition, but I feel like we do have a doctor of linguistics here, and I think I would rather have you give the definition of what is a Mondegreen.
So, it's a Mondegreen is when you hear song lyrics. So you're not seeing them, you're hearing them. It could be a song, it could be a poem. And the words that you think are in the song are not the words that are actually in the song. So not rock the Casbah, right? Becomes like stock the cash box or
exactly
stop. Yeah, that now, kind of thing.
Did you have one? I have to ask, do you have a Mondegreen from your childhood or from your youth? Do you have like a famous one that you got wrong?
You know, the Bad Moon on the Rise, I think that one is like a classic example. I didn't know what those words were until quite some time. I don't know if I had bathroom on the right, but yeah, Bad Moon Rising is definitely
bathroom
one
on
of mine.
The right. Okay. Well, okay. Mine was pretty silly. There's a spiritual called Bringing in the Sheaves. Are you familiar with the song? Now, as a child, I thought they said bringing in the sheets. So I just pictured like these housewives out singing as they're bringing in the sheets. So that was me. That was bringing in the sheets. That was my Mondegreen. Now, the subtitle of Mondegreens, and the reason we're talking about Mondegreens and what you just described, you said, you know, you hear it, but what you thought you heard is not what you heard. And I think one of the things that part of what you study, correct me if I'm wrong, is not just language and words, but also how your body is involved in that. And your mouth is definitely part of your body. So, and your ears are part of your body. So I feel like I want to dive into this a little bit, considering this is radio and this is audio. And, you know, I was inspired by this just by reading something that had nothing really to do with this. But then I found a new word, Mondegreens. I didn't know. And there's a whole history to what Mondegreens are. Were you aware of all this history?
I am. It's a good one.
All right. Do you want to tell it? Because you're
sure. I mean, okay. So some of these things that language does, these phonological processes, phonological processes. So I'm a phonetician, right? Or trained as a phonetician. That's the kind of laboratory science that I do, which means that I'm interested in speech, you know, like the sounds of speech, how it's structured, how it comes out of the mouth, how it works in the brain, right? phonology, right, is the study of sound patterns. So we're not as much interested in like the body, right? I'm interested in the body. When they're not as interested in the articulators, how things are coming out of the mouth, they're interested in like what sounds do over a language, over the world's languages over time, right? Okay, so a lot of these phonological processes are named after people, either like people who, you know, discovered them or coined them, or like people who like did the thing. So Mondegreen is an example of a Mondegreen. It's something that a writer recalled, like a memory of how her mother used to like this, like mispronounce or thought that song lyrics were different lyrics. I hesitate to use mispronounce or like mishearing or like call it a mistake, because, you know, in the moment, and people who do this, who like often pick it up in childhood, you know, don't know. Who's to say it's a mistake? Right? Just because
I like where you're going there. Like, maybe the way you heard it is the way it really is. That's okay. I'm with that.
Anyway.
All right, so you're telling her story. So that's...
Okay, well, that's essentially the story. It's like a writer coined the term for this thing that we do when we, like, mishear lyrics or, you know, assign words. Essentially, it is assigning words that we know to strings of sounds we recognize. And we do this kind of thing all the time. We can maybe... There's a lot of directions we can go in this. We could talk about... like why the brain lets us do this and like how we hear. We could talk about how we read.
I'm talking about all of that. Okay. All right. Well, all right. There's some perspectives here, and I want to get your thoughts on these here. And the first one I'm going to give to you is that sounds don't influence meaning. Sounds convey meaning, and meaning is a mental entity. So to convey like a distinct meaning, we represent them with distinct sounds. Now, do you feel that's an accurate representation of what language is?
No.
Or talk to me.
Oh, where to start? Okay. So, number one, this is ableist. This is phonocentric. So, in my work, in my current work in writing, I am, you know, taking linguistic theory to task for only considering sound, or considering sound more deeply than other forms of languaging, which would be writing or sign. So people like to say like, and signed languages, like it's this whole category that's separate and only applies to like differently abled or like differently embodied people. But every single person uses sign to make meaning. Okay. So what is meaning? Obviously, that's like quite an existential question. We can maybe circle back to this, but
just a little bit.
Yeah. So what I work on, when we're thinking about embodiment is exactly the types of meaning that sound has. So for example, like sound doesn't influence meaning is wild. It's why we vary things. So we can enter this maybe from another conversation or another point in this conversation. Bad words maybe sound bad, right? So, you know, they might have like K sounds in them or K sounds in them or K sounds in them, something that's like harder than an ah or a la or something, right? That sort of like harder sound thing, applies across the world's languages. This is like a sound pattern that we see. So like bad words, like sound bad. Or for example, something like mushy or yucky, icky, sticky, you know, that kind of like something that is tactile. And we call it like sound symbolism. They absolutely have meaning. Here's and group together, right? Before we even start thinking about like what they maybe actually apply to and like who uses them and when. Another example is sirens or rooster calls, like the onomatopoeia, right? Like right. The words that are sounds. Like, right. When you write down what a sound is, like crash or bang or zip, right? Like, those sorts of words that point to something in nature, like a rooster, or again, like an alarm, like a police car. They are represented differently in the world's languages, but they pull from like an inventory of sounds. So in like Spanish, and it's like kikariki, kikariki, right? But in English, it's cock-a-doodle-doo. But both of them have like this sound in them, which is, you know, of the things that we share, like our bodies, like the roofs of our mouths, like all people, no matter what language they're using, like know how to make this harder sound. They hear something that objectively exists, like, and is the same. Like, rooster calls are perhaps like not accented, although that's an open question. Do animals have accents? Maybe. It is like, ostensibly, you could measure a rooster call. You could put it into a machine and be like, this is exactly what it quote unquote sounds like, but you still need a hearer to do the interpreting. It's very interesting to ask, like, what are we doing the same? Like, we're all putting K's in a rooster sound, right? Somehow we're all doing the same thing. A lot of places we're not all doing the same thing.
Well, it does, but also you said something else that brings other things to mind. You said it's got to be interpreted. So it's not just the sound or the word or the phrase or the phrasing could be one thing in one
and
culture.
And this is where our field splits in half. We haven't even got that far. Okay. We don't even know what meaning is. Exactly. We don't even know what a sound is, but we're already split in half between and you need a hearer.
Well, you said it. So, all right, now, let me ask you another question now. You thought that was a very ableist definition of sound. Now, this is another perspective here. It says here, human beings the world over use sound rather than writing to communicate, with notable exception of various sign languages. Until relatively recent times, most of the languages on our planet lacked a written form. And, you know, they mention how in order to spread the gospel, missionaries have been creating written forms of neglected languages in various countries. And now it also says that even one day, if we do reach the point where every one of Earth's 6,000 plus languages has a written form, writing is still a form of speech. Sounds represented by symbols on a paper or a screen. It says not even Chinese or Japanese, which choose Chinese characters, constitute an exception. Chinese characters represent individual syllables, and close to 80% of Chinese characters include clues to pronunciation. So what are your thoughts on that, on the idea that actually written and writing is a whole new thing?
I'm like, we're going to fight. I put that in the notes. I'm like, where'd you pull this from? I'm mad at everybody. Where to start? Yes. Modern writing is an imperialist construction. What? A lot of the work. Okay. There is something to think about of like, when we think about like writing, I think when we say writing, I think a lot of people go to like an essay or a letter, or maybe even a text message, like, or like, you know, pencil to paper, like all of that is like writing. Okay. Here's one of the things that I take like maybe the most umbrage with in what we've just heard. And that is that it's writing is and has always meant to capture sound. That's certainly not the case in my opinion. So we have, like, you know, cuneiform and like the oldest forms of language that we have, things like linear A and linear
Symbol,
B, these types of writing that haven't even been like fully deciphered. We know that a lot of what remains to us to look at these oldest forms of writing, what anything that would be like adjacent to what we could think of as a text, like something that you could like would be permanent, you can hold in your hand or whatever. What we have left, a lot of them are receipts, right? And these symbols, like this cuneiform text, these like receipts, I mean, it wasn't approximating sound because none of these people shared languages, but it was something like, oh, okay, this is like numbers, or this is an olive, you know, or something like that. Like, this is wool. Like, it was all about a tangible thing. It was a symbol. It was an icon, right? Like something that pointed to a thing in the environment. It existed because people didn't share language, which means it couldn't have been referential to sound. It was conceptually referential, you know, of like wool, cotton, right? Like these things that were being like traded. Okay. We can go even like farther back and think about how we evolved language as a species in general. We most certainly used signs and symbols as a species before we were speakers in the way that we are now, because our evolution, like when we became upright, forward facing, bipedal, hairless, sedentary creatures, right? All of that involved communication, and we did not have the lung capacity to speak in the way that we think of speech until after we were fully upright. So in this process of us like evolving, you know, becoming like sedentary da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da- things.
Okay.
Okay. Right. Yeah.
Okay. All right. All right. Clearly not going to argue that. So you would say you would completely disagree with the argument that the world used sound rather than writing to communicate, or
rather is what I disagree with.
Okay. Well, then here's my question. And maybe this sounds banal, but then what constitutes writing versus drawing? Would a symbol, there's a certain, let's just say, every letter has to be drawn. So where does drawing end and writing begin?
What a fantastic question. And I point to the scholars who created the first Quran, right? Which is a work of art, unquestionably a work of art. I mean, you look at the practice of putting this script in a circle, of taking like a word and expanding the letters around into a circle to give it a shape, to give it like different physical material properties. Where is the line between language and writing there in those, or language and art, writing and art in those practices? Right. You can look at medieval texts with illuminations where the first letter of a paragraph is like a cityscape,
right.
Supposed to be like what heaven looks like or something like that. Like where is the line between art and writing there? I mean, look at poetry. How is that any different? Like visually, we play with the words on the page, even if like the font, like the script is comparable to like an essay or, medical records, even though like the A's on all those pages look the same. Like where's the line? And you could ask the same thing about like speaking, like when does speech become song? Right? Like, I'm not sure. Like, that's just me, like, really kind of asking. And part of me as a scientist is like, we got to draw a line somewhere. So where are we drawing it?
Well,
All
right. Well, now you see, let's back up just a little bit, because you said something there about when does speech become song? And that also speaks to, we're talking about how do we interpret words, right? Okay. There are cultural filters. There's going to be, perhaps your age when you hear it, and the environment and when you heard it. So there are a lot of factors that go into how we perceive something. But I'm wondering now, do you feel that? Let me back it up a little bit then. That what the hearing process, I'm calling it a two-step process here: auditory perception and then meaning making. So, auditory perception. Do you feel like that is equal to visual perception, and just in terms of navigating the world? And do you feel like they are? Do they? What is your take as a linguist? Where they meet or where they diverge?
Okay, I pulled out my like phonetics text.
Okay, what's
for when we for if and when, you know, because there's a lot here, right? Of like the process of hearing, we can talk like physiologically. So vision and hearing are like physiologically different in a number of, and like obviously it's different organs, right? But essentially this like, it is like hearing, like auditory processing and then meaning making, which essentially is like categorization. It's like analysis and categorization that happens simultaneously. And it's also planning. So all three of those things are governed by different parts of the brain. So your brain, like it's essentially, it's electrochemical. It works like the same way that any circuit would work. Like if we're actually breaking it down physically, you know, like you're getting like a message. One message is coming in though, and that signal gets split, right? It gets sent to different parts of the brain, and it is still an open question as far as hearing is concerned. If they are like, if it's split the way a prism splits light, or if it's essentially like bounced, like copies are bounced, that it makes a difference. Because so part of what I'm interested in is how identity information is taken, like how it's processed from the speech signal. So if we pulled a caller in, right, we could ask them to say hello, you know, good Monday.
Right? Hello, good Monday. Yes, hello.
Good Monday.
yes, hello.
Yeah, like, right. you and I could make a decision like on air about like their age or their gender or where we think they're from in New York or if they're from New York or, you know, that kind of thing. And we'd probably be right. I mean, we'd be close, right? Let's say that we would definitely get their age. You know, we might be able to say like geographically where in the city they're from, like north, south, east, west, and, you know, their gender probably. Like it's right. I mean, and it kind of depends on all those other factors at the same time, right?
Well, you know, let me pause you there because I want to say this. I mean, I think, you know, I don't know if scientifically if you're splitting, is this where we split the line? But, you know, the thing about voices, and I say this as someone who's, you know, been on the air a long time. I've done voice work and I have a lot of friends who do voice work. And, you know, people picture a voice. I mean, people have some vision of me. And
oh, yeah.
Yeah, having the voice I do is, you know, it's a...
It's a gift.
The mixed blessing. Let's say I'll put it like that. But I'll tell you a funny story about that. But the point I'm making is that sometimes, though, you know, you hear a voice and you get a personality, and you completely conjure up someone based on what your perception of that voice and personality should be. I mean, you know, clearly radio for a long time was, you know, when audio drama is a big part of that, you know, especially now it's made a comeback. But I really do think that, you know, those references, those meanings, those images you give, you might be right, but you might be completely wrong, you know, and it might be just how you perceive those voices and those accents. I mean, do you disagree?
I don't disagree. The listener, the hearer, the perceiver has more control over meaning than the producer.
Definitely.
We lose control of an utterance. Like, because again, like this physiological pathway, right? Like it's a wave. It's a pressure wave. You know, the same way with like the light that is traveling across our entire universe to get to us. And we know like exactly when it's going to shift to red so we can like, yeah, it's like that of like, as soon as that light leaves, it's gone, it's going, it's traveling. The sound wave is the same, right? Whether we're in the room, all of this, right? So the perceiver has so much, the only place meaning is being processed is inside the listener. right? Like, I can throw as much intent into a word as I want, and somebody, I cannot guarantee that someone's going to hear it the way I meant it, you know?
This is true. And
everybody knows this, right? And this idea of, like, pulling identity information out of a voice, like, this is a lot of what I work on, because somewhere I say something like cat, tie it, cat, you know, like, like all of the, like you say it in these different ways, your brain starts to put it in different places of like,
I picture different cats.
Cat, right? Again, yes, exactly. Like you might see a kitten, you might see a this, you might see a tiger, you might see whatever. If I just said, picture a cat, every single person in the room is going to have a different cat. And they're going to, you know, and so that's the thing is like, you have a cat box in your head. Every cat you've ever encountered lives in
yes,
that box.
You do. Yes, you do.
Every time you've ever seen the word cat written down, every time you've ever, right? Like all of those experiences live in that one box. And so when you're listening to me, you're being like, all of those were cat, but I don't know if they were all the same speaker. So
true.
They all go in the box, but maybe they have a different label on them. Maybe they have a label on them like this one was weird, or this person was being sarcastic, or it's like that kind of what we call indexicality. It really is like a gigantic library in your brain, and it's holding on to every experience you've ever had. So it's that of like, maybe most of it is not meant for retrieval. Most of it is saved in order for you to have a more fine-grained experience of your environment, of like the present moment. That's what your brain is attempting to do, is give you a seamless now.
Well,
live in the present thing, live in the present is exactly what your brain is trying to help you do. You know, we actually have a lag. We have like a processing lag with the present or whatever, but yeah.
Well, the processing lag with the present is definitely something that we could do an entire show about. But so, you know, that also brings to mind a couple other things, because I found. Were you familiar, by the way?
Well, yeah. Sorry.
Okay.
Like what we're talking about sits right in the middle of this.
Which. You mean
Mondegreens?
Yes, Mondegreens. Yes, it does. Yes, it does. And so that coming back to the Mondegreens, and I definitely want some people to, well, we do take some calls. I would love to hear people tell us like songs they totally misinterpreted or sound lyrics, or, you know, I found some great articles on things that you thought were true when you were a kid, or you know, you filled in the blanks with just kid logic. So but the other thing is, you were talking about how we, you know, every cat is cataloged and there's the cat box, but same thing for, you know, all the other, you know, things that you are, whether it's authority or sexy or pretty or old or wise, or, you know, all those different, you know, types of voices that you think or that suggest that to you also affect how you take in, you know, what somebody's saying. So how do you feel that sounds influence meaning in human language? How would you define that? Or if I were in your class, how would you make me understand how sounds influence meaning? You know,
it's so silly. I mean, it's so silly that you could imagine they couldn't, mm-hmm. if you're a sound user, because, I mean, we can think about like minced oaths. So when you say like cheese and rice, or, you know, like shut the front door, like that kind of thing where I'm switching out a bad word, or like,
oh, for an expletive for something. Okay, I got you.
An expletive, yeah, yes. Cheese and rice, or, you know, yeah, like shut the front door, like those kind of things where we know there's an explicit phrase that sounds pretty much exactly like this, but none of these words are bad, so I can use this in polite conversation,
right,
to like, you know, go almost as far as a swear would. Like minced oaths have been.
I've never heard minced oaths.
That's the beginning.
Minced oaths. What is that?
Minced. oaths, because an oath, because it goes back to like religious, like
this is a phrase, this is a thing, minced oaths.
Minced oaths, yes.
Minced oaths, O A T H. Wow, yeah. Minced oaths. I've never heard of that.
So
and that's you not can a, look like it's not a band, right? You know,
like those are a thing because you weren't allowed to like take the Lord's name in vain. So you could say like, "Gosh darn it!" Like, "Gosh darn it" is a minced oath. Because, minced like, you'd oath. Be, like, making an oath, like, if you said it bad, right? The bad way.
Well, they did that a lot in comic books with the character.
Exactly.
Especially.
Yeah. Holy moo cow, Batman.
Like, yeah, that was not. And Luke Cage was really bad. It was like, "Sweet Christmas," or, you know, "Holy mother of."
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they did. Yeah. And then, like, Anchorman, like, "Uncle Jonathan and his corncob pipe," like that kind of stuff, which, like, it, again, okay, so this is a really good example because we get.
Did you say Johnny Dangerously? Is that the movie you're talking about?
Uncle Jonathan and his corncob pipe.
Okay.
We get.
Johnny Dangerously.
That's the thing is, we've gotten farther away from whatever this bad thing is, but everybody knows how it functions because the way it's said, it's like, you know, "Shut the front door, shut the front door. Like, get out of here, get out of town." Like, that kind of stuff is, like, obviously sound has meaning. Now, to back up a little, like, again, like, I still don't know how you make this argument. I don't know how you stand in a room with a straight face and try and say this, because have you experienced music? I don't know if I'd like to introduce you to music. Not even song, okay? Not even song. Can I just sit you down in front of Schubert? For any amount of time, like the drum, sir.
You mean the talking animals. Drum? The talking
man,
drum.
Like the elephant. Does sound make meaning?
Okay, I'm going to tell that guy to go. All right, so now I have another question for you, though. You know, coming into how we interpret language, and like you said, all these different identifiers. I love minced oaths. I never heard that before. It should be like a heavy metal band. All right, but you know, there everybody can do, you know, the newscaster, and tonight on the news, another man jumped off the top of, you know, that's that standard newscaster. But there was a time, and there's a reason why there's that cadence and that just straight delivery, and there's a reason you take it seriously and whatnot, versus a time when you needed a town crier. And the way the town crier had to do what he had to do, or and to get people's attention. So I just want to get your thoughts on the newscaster versus the town crier, and just how we take in, let's just say, not just words, but important information.
You want me to speak about the master of elocution, that is Demosthenes? I'm happy to do that at any time. right, we have the town crier is such an interesting role, job. Elected position, right? That's actually what's maybe interesting. Like, this parallel to today.
Well, radio is we're the town crier right now.
Well, because like an influencer is someone who we've like chosen, like a group of people have chosen to speak on certain topics and like have invested authority in. And that's like, aside from just the speaking part, right? That's like, but the town crier was somebody who had authority invested in them. Like, anyone can stand in the street and scream. That's always been true, right? But there are some people we just like don't give it to somebody, right? We don't say, you know, this guy, we believe.
Exactly. Whereas, not everybody gets paid to stand in the street and scream. Go ahead.
What's interesting, like the newscaster too, like we've invested some officialdom in this.
So I'm wondering like what your thoughts are on how and why we invest in officialdom on something, you know, and if there are things linguistically that are you mentioned the masters of elocution, is there something specific about elocution that just makes us pay more attention, or, you know, what do you give us some secrets?
There's a lot here. So why do we invest like authority? Like, why do we care what other people have to say is maybe one question of like, we have complete linguistic systems in our heads. Like if they run our thoughts, like we actually maybe don't need another person to have a full experience of life, right? Like, or maybe that's also an open question. Not just like philosophically or whatever, but actually like physiologically, like can we, you know, process the world without another human? Like if we were left alone in the wild, aside from like needing food, like will we make it? So what's maybe interesting about the authority, like why we listen to other people, what's interesting is that our system is fully formed, like, but our cognition, like we're trying again, like to categorize our experience. Like the more things that we encounter, the quote unquote, like smarter we are, like our brain is able to make more sense, better sense. Again, like finer grained detail. It's like you see one melon, right? It's like, you know how kids, when they like, everything is like a fire truck, like fire truck, and they're like right when they point to the fire truck, but then every car is a fire truck or anything loud is a fire truck. It's like they're making like this very sweeping generalization. Your brain actually does that with basically everything. It's just you give it like more examples of four-wheeled objects and it starts to make a finer grain distinction to be like, okay, I need a fire truck category. I can keep my fire truck category, which I love, right? But then I also am gonna have just trucks. Like you experience enough things to be like, okay, we separate these two. And so listening to other people, like absorbing other people's experiences, allows us to make those finer grain distinctions without like having to go anywhere. Like this is why we like reading. This is why like entertainment is a thing and we watch television and or even reality television about like what other people's lives are like. Or we like listen to other people, like when people go to vacation and they come back and they tell us all about what they experience, it's kind of like we're there a little bit. Or, you know, one of our family members goes to meet somebody else or tells us stories about our grandparents, like who passed away before we were born. It's like everything that we know about those people is filtered through others. But does that mean that I don't know them or I don't, you know, like that they're not like part of me, right? It doesn't, just because I heard it from somebody else, does that mean like it doesn't inform who I am or what I do? Like it certainly does. This is why we don't go around being like singular experiencing machines with nothing to share, right?
Well, it also suggests some other things too, just in terms of, you know, the more you break down how we as human beings work, how we learn, how we process, how we become, you know, let's just say biased, because, you know, that meaning, a lot of that meaning comes with bias of our experience. It's easy to see how this can be used against us. So my other question to you now here, because there's quite a bit to, well, now, did we cover, there are a couple of things that we touched upon and then jumped ahead on. So I want to know what we missed before I go further down the list, because I want to talk about the McGurk effect. Did you know about the McGurk effect?
Yes, I know a lot about the McGurk. Before we get there, so people, this thing about like monogreens, like, and meaning making and maybe sound change in general. So phonology, like sound patterns, what is quote unquote right? Like that's sort of what's, we're talking about monogreens where it's like, this person wrote a song. It has actual lyrics that you can look up and you can go and see like what it meant, right? Or what it was supposed to be. But we also do, there are similar phenomena at work. Something like, things like egg corns, which is one of my favorites. An egg corn, like mondegreen. Mondegreen is an example of a mondegreen, right?
Well, just for those who don't know, the in the story, the the word was, it was from a poem that her mom read to her when she was a child, this author, and she always heard the misheard the words laying him on the green. Now, and the words were laid him on the green. She heard it as Lady Mondegreen. So
yeah, and so there, an eggcorn, an eggcorn is an eggcorn in that, like, it's supposed, quote unquote, like, it's a different pronunciation of acorn, like what falls off an oak tree. And so people, it has to do with a lot to do with writing. It's like, if you've never seen the word acorn written down, but you've heard acorns being referred to and you know what they look like, they're sort of egg shaped. So it's this idea of like, and in places where that sort of raising, like Minnesota, you know, the northern states where it's like egg, big, you know, like acorn, you get egg corn, right? It makes sense. So other ones are like cut, like that sort of end up in the middle of all of these things. Cause there's also like malapropisms. That's maybe a little different, but so you get,
well,
something like,
it's almost cut, like that, but almost
pass,
like
mustard,
right?
Not, you know, like, cause it's cut the mustard, but then it's also pass muster. Pass right. Muster is the phrase.
Correct.
Right. But
it gets
cut the mustard is a thing too that kind of means the same thing. So it's like this thing of like pass mustard doesn't make sense. But a lot of people say it because they have never seen, they've only heard pass mustard in their head. They hear with the D. But it's my, but so, okay, we're talking about a very subtle difference in the way it sounds, right? And a lot of people will be like, oh, you're dumb. Like, you didn't know that that was like a saying from like 1910. Like, it's like pass muster. Like, it's this thing that is the same process in our minds that puts like cut the mustard and pass muster together. Or like for all intensive purposes, which is like another one people really hate, but it makes sense why you get there. That like sound pattern is the same thing that's happening with the Mondegreen, except for you don't have the lyrics, you know, with an eggcorn. It's just like a pattern of sound that you're getting, that's getting transferred in a different way in a subset of the population. So a sound pattern that's getting transferred in a different way by a subset of the population is exactly how all sound change starts. So like we are pointing to things like pacifically instead of specifically and being like, this is the worst thing. Everyone is so ignorant when they talk this way. And it's like, actually sound, our language could be changing in that direction. Like this small subset of people could actually be ahead as far as sound change is concerned, right? And the rest of us are behind because it starts as an S curve. It's like a handful of people, then everybody, then nobody else uses the old sounds anymore. Like,
this is very true. Well, a lot of accents have
it doesn't take
that
long. Old English was like not that long ago.
Yes. Like I said, a lot of accents evolved that way. You wouldn't realize or think that, you know, a Jamaican accent came from Irish until you listen and you go, you know, so there are a lot of things like that. Now,
you're like, okay, yeah. Exactly. So this is what I mean is like, we could be looking at sound change in progress and saying like all of these things, all of these different final, like Mondegreens, eggcorns, they could all be kind of sound change in progress. Right. Now I'm not that any phonologists are listening to this. They'd all probably be a little mad, but
why would they be mad?
I just like to look at things from a really universal perspective. Oh, and so
you're the rebel. The linguist rebel. All right. Well, you are tuned to listener sponsored radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York and on the web at WBAI.org. And we're talking about language. We're talking about Mondegreens. We're talking about the instinct of language. What do we hear? What do we take it to mean? What do we turn it into? Why? And we're here with Dr. Kelly Wright. I still like calling you a racial linguist, just so you know.
That's fine. I'm not that.
All right. Okay.
Good. I wear many hats. I think, interesting. There's so much to talk about. I want to talk about McGurk.
Yes.
But maybe we'll have time to come back to like characters and how they represent sound and like,
No.
Tough, thorough thought though of it all.
Well, we can definitely talk about the characters, you know, because that's the other thing too. You know, what certain sounds or where you hear something will affect how you will take it in. So, you know, when you say a character, tell me what you mean when you say a character.
Oh, but you mentioned this before of like Chinese or Japanese characters in this quote include cues to pronunciation.
Yes, yes. All right, let's go back. Let's. I don't want to let that go.
Well, wouldn't it be cool if English did that? I guess that's like maybe one of my, because they're making this argument of like even these languages that look different than something Western are encoding sound, so that must mean that like every writing system is doing this, and maybe it is to some extent, but what's interesting maybe about the way like these character systems make use, like productive use of the ways in which they look, right, to tell you like what they're supposed to mean, to make the language less ambiguous, which obviously is like, it's an issue, right? And so we think about O-U-G-H in English, like my example, like tough, thorough, thought, though, like all of these, there's no cue to pronunciation. We can't look at one. There are a lot of words in English that we can't look at and know exactly how they're supposed to sound. Like, yes, we have sound rules. But in every language, those rules have exceptions. But in many of the world's languages, the ways that they build words, we've talked about this before, like morphology, like the word parts and how they come together, are governed by rules. And a lot of them tell you how the words are supposed to sound, but English doesn't do that. So this idea that all of writing is supposed, like it's, like in the sentence itself, right? There is evidence that this right expands beyond that.
Well, this is true, and so I. Well, you know, you mentioned something before. You know, I gave you another definition. You called it a labelist, and so a lot of the study of language in many ways has been biased. So. There's, you know, I could see why you might be a little bit of a rebel just thinking outside the box, because you're taking into account things that perhaps other scholars would not. So people are calling, even though I haven't given out the number. So that means people, you know, either want to share their own monograms or they just have to call. So I will give out the number. The phone number here is 212-209-2877. And I'll take this call here and let's see if this is actually a person. Hello, you're on the air. Hello? For a while, like for the last half hour, they've been calling and then calling and then calling. So
I am satisfied with my insurance company. Thank you.
What did you hear? Did you hear somebody ask for insurance?
No, I'm just being silly.
Okay. 212-209-2877, and yes, you can share your Monday Green if there's. Because there were some great ones. So
there's
go back,
some weird ones.
You know, there were some really, I have some fun ones to read.
Do you have some favorites?
Well, there are a couple things. There are some that I like. I wanted people to call, but I also heard, I looked at just the idea of what things that you thought that you misinterpreted as a child. And some of them were just just wow, you know, the children have such imagination, you know, it's like, wow, that's great. I love that. It's not true, but I love that. So I will go to some of that in a little while. But I want to go back to what you were saying. And
McGurk.
Yes, McGurk. Well, we can talk about McGurk because...
Well, it's fine. What do you want to go back to?
No, I want to go back to... You were talking about characters, and what I was touching upon is, you know, sort of the bias in language, in the study of language, and I wanted to know your thoughts on that. Do you feel there are blind spots, or do you feel, you know, overall in your field, or do you feel it's changing, evolving? Like, what is... being understood, or do you feel this should be more understood just about how we are looking at language?
Yeah, so there's a number, bias makes it sound like people went out and did this on purpose, like in a bad way. And that's certainly not what I mean. I think that imbalance is maybe a better way to think about it, because like our data sets, okay, so all the world's language, like if we're going to do science in the way we would like every scientist, no matter what their discipline is, wants like all of the data, you know? So I would like to, like, ideally, right? If I was going to ask questions about language, I could look at everything, the corpus of all human communication, like everything that every human being who could use language has ever produced for all time, which is like 117 billion people over, right? So the idea that we could ever actually really like achieve balance, like that's, it's like not possible, right? Like I can't get everything everyone's ever said or written or signed. So knowing that is like, okay, well, what do we have? Like the subsection of data that we're interested in, or that we've, you know, built our theories on, is just a lot of speech. Like most of it is about speech, and it does like constrains. In my opinion, like some of our theories just simply aren't adequate because they haven't considered enough about like languaging, like in general. Like it's just like, it's not even, it's like you haven't looked at the world's languages to draw this conclusion, or, you know, this really only makes sense for people in the West because of these things, or, you know, like, yeah. So it's very difficult to generalize because we just don't have enough data. So that doesn't mean that specific work on sound change or like sound patterns or anything that, like I work on sound, like I work on speech too, even though it's, you know, it's mostly what our field does. But I just like to be able to walk in to what I'm doing with like that in mind of what I am saying is only relevant, you know, to this group of sounds or these groups of speakers. You know, it isn't relevant to just how people use language, which is often like what we're called to answer questions about as a field. So a lot of what I try to do is to bring in work that's already been done, right? There's so much work on like humanity and history and, you know, our life ways in the past. Like, for example, okay, so I like work for the dictionary. I often have to like go back and look at like archival texts that are written in like script that we don't use to try and figure out how someone's using a word. And I can't go 500 years in the past to talk to these people, to get on Twitter and figure out like, okay, there's maybe like two senses of this word like going around. It could be referring to like a product we don't use anymore, you know, something like suet. Right? That you just can't go to the grocery store and pick up suet. It's not something that we eat in the United States. It's like, it's that kind of thing of all of this stuff is like you said, like tied to a person and a place. And it has so much to do with like who and when and where you are, like what quote unquote like meaning is. So does that mean like I can go back and read something and because I interpret it in as myself in the present, that isn't what it means. Like this idea of like hearing a song, you know, like Blinded by the Light, right? Like Bruce Springsteen, like wrapped up like a douche. Like that's definitely one that I have too. I don't know what a douche was. It didn't make any sense to me. Yeah, you know, like there's so much that just doesn't make sense. Does that mean that my meaning is not real? Because I'm still laughing about that.
You're on the air.
Oh, all right. Thought it was on hold. Okay, hi. Hi.
Yes.
Things that I misinterpreted as a kid.
Yes. Oh, okay, you've got one. I'd love to hear it.
What was that?
I said, yeah, I'd love to hear it. I'd love to hear what.
Well, one of the obvious ones, I guess, because it's entertainment and meant to deceive or it's fiction, is television, movies, but specifically the romance between the genders, and then getting a little older as a teenager, and then things changing in my late teens or maybe 20s between the genders out there. So it was the romance movies. I took them literally. It wasn't like that.
Really? So, like, did you like lean in for the kiss and not get the kiss? Like, what happened? Did you, was there some John Hughes moment that happened? What happened?
It never got.
Gotcha.
I never got rejected on the lean.
Okay,
but that was a few.
That's good. You're batting all right there. You never got rejected on the lean. All right.
So I had to get to a certain place before the lead. But one of the big movies that made an impression on me was The Blue Rose, which was Steve Reeves, and he was the thief of Baghdad in a prior movie. He was the Hercules guy, you know, Mr. Universe. And there was this movie called The Blue Rose, and he was sent on a mission quest of all these trials and tribulations and dangerous things. And he had to go find the Blue Rose because somebody put a spell on the king's daughter. And then there's this whole romance and it's like, oh, I got to, you know, fight the monsters. And then he falls in love with the princess. And then everybody says, hey, this guy's not so bad. And then he saves the land because the guy didn't get to marry the princess. And he took the spell away. So he's pissed. And so he comes back and he's going to like destroy. And then Steve Reeves gets help from an angel throughout the whole thing. It's a great movie. It's one of my favorite movies. But anyway, the romance of that, and then you get out there and you go, it's a lot different.
Yeah, there are monsters, but you may not get the... So, West Side Story, all right.
Yeah, that
so...
was another one that made a big impression, yeah.
Interesting.
And then I went to an all-boys high school, vocational. So that kind of, nothing much went on there. And then we had a prom with the all girls high school. So that was great. At least they did something like that. But then I got the flu and I gave my ticket away to some guy who couldn't afford to go. So, but I didn't get that whole interaction.
This definitely sounds like a little more than, so you definitely did not have the teenage years that you thought you would have from having watched movies.
Yes.
I got you.
It's good there that your boys' school years were uneventful. There's been plenty of horrible movies about that.
This is true. What was that? She said, at least your boys' school years were not horrible because there have been movies where they are. So,
you know what? That's a good observation. That's really good. Yeah, that's a gift. That's wonderful.
There it is. Well, thank you. What's your name,
sir? All right,
sir?
Sergeant Mike. I salute you.
All right, I appreciate you. Thank you, sir. All right, there you go. All right, so here's one I thought was fun. That this was from a BuzzFeed here. It says they asked members of BuzzFeed to the funniest thing they, as a kid, ever misunderstood. So I'll just pepper the next 45 minutes with these periodically. This one says, I used to think clowns were a race of people like any other. Like, I love that whole concept. It's like a skit on Saturday Live. It's like they're a race of people.
You're just born a clown.
You're just born. And yeah, it's funny to me because that used to be like a thing I used to do with my friends. We used to do, whoa! You know, we used to do the clown voice all the time. That was a thing.
Goes,
oh, well, you're a fool. You know, we just.
Oh, King Razor.
Yeah, exactly. The Gildersleeves, like, oh, the exploding shoes. So that was and then here's another one. Well, no, I'm not gonna read that one. So let's go back to where you were or what we were starting to talk about. And just coming to, you know, we were talking about how we have come to understand language, and you were gonna get into a couple things here. Or I can ask you a question.
I mean, there's so much to talk about. Do you have a question?
Well, it's more of a to bring the conversation somewhere. Mm-hmm. But no, I want to.
Sorry, I ate a piece of candy. Okay. We're thinking like there's instinct here that as part of this conversation, or at least in our title, right? Of there's maybe a why that's like sitting under this. It's like, why do our brains work this way? Why is like sound pattern matching important?
Right. We didn't even talk about the McGurk effect. Yeah.
We can talk about the McGurk effect.
No, go ahead. We can lead into it.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, we asked why do we care what other people say? Like the perspectives of others, like why is that important to us? It has something to do with this like instinct thing. We have an instinct to perceive our environment. We want to know, like our brains want to know what's around us. We actually start, like you were saying, like we have an image of a speaker, like before we hear them, we conjure like a character in our heads when someone's talking to us, you know, That's part of us. It's part of how we're like, that seems a little shady. Like, it's like going with your gut. Like, there's something off about this and I'm not like okay with it. Like, that is part of our instinct. Like, where we get that sort of sense of maybe danger or discomfort, risk is part of our linguist, is part of our entire sensory perception experience, right? And our language is part of that. So, when we're doing this categorization thing, it really comes from something very basic, very, very ancient, very primal in our DNA that is like protecting us in like the raw, empty environment. This is something that helps us sense danger, that lets us know like who we're related to, like helps us recognize kin. So yeah, when we're thinking about like the instinct, like why this is part of what we do, like why we're even trying to say this is right and that's wrong, or this is something I recognize. Like when we're hearing music, and we don't know what the words are, we're trying to put it in this place of like, this is something I recognize. This is something I recognize. You know, so it's like, I recognize wrapped up like a douche faster than I revved up like a deuce or whatever it actually is. It's like this thing of like, you know, that I made sense of this. And in the moment, the sense that I made of it was fine. It didn't, the ambiguity does not put me at risk. And so your brain is totally fine with like keeping like stock the cash box as this song lyric, because who cares if you misheard a song lyric? Like, you're not going to go hungry. It's like that thing of like, our brain kind of doesn't care.
All right. Now I'm going to give an audio example of what you're talking about right now for our listeners. Hello, you're on the air. Yes, who is this?
I just love whenever you have the guest that you have on tonight.
I know, she's great, right?
Oh my goodness.
All right.
I'm in love with her mind.
Yes, same. And now, what's your name, sir?
Ian.
Ian. All right, so Ian, did you want to share a monogram? Do you have something you misunderstood, or did you have a question?
I just have some deeper thoughts on language.
We'd love to hear them.
Yeah, I kind of came to the appreciation of linguistics a little bit late in life. But I have a cousin who is married to somebody who teaches linguistics at a university in Michigan. And I visited them some years ago, and I got one of her textbooks and just decided to read it. And in, like, the first chapter, you know, a question is asked, you know, like, if you ask the, you know, regular person how many languages that they think they are, they'd probably say 50, 60, 100, but there are thousands of languages that, you know, I guess through human evolution have come and gone. And, you know, it just fascinates me. You know, the book says that the study of linguistics is really like the study of human evolution. And, you know, if you really think about it, what our ancient ancestors had to do to come up with, like, you know, all the scripts and the agreements on what a certain sound means, you know, it's mind-blowing. I often wonder, like, say, for instance, when the first European met, say, for instance, somebody from China, you know, how did they, you know, interpret each other's languages to be able to do trade, you know?
Yeah, no, listen, that's the desire to communicate supersedes a lot of, you know, I think the language barrier. You know, the language barrier is just how do you, I can only imagine in some ways it's like learning a program. Like if you want to get this program, that you knew another program that could do this, you just have to figure out how this program does the same thing the other one did. So, because
they're all, you know, all kinds of questions come up. Like, say, for instance, you know, there's some people who theorize that, say, for instance, babies are born with certain templates in their brains. Hello?
Yeah, no.
Oh,
listen.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that babies are born with certain templates in their brains, so, you know, they could pick up, like, say, for instance, Mandarin or Korean much easier than someone who was born, you know, from another culture.
Well, I totally, you know, in my sci-fi belief, I believe that, you know, there's a lot more to DNA. I think that we are genetically deposed to a lot of things. dependent on a number of factors, family, location. Yeah. Thing. But again, that's just my complete belief. But
yeah, thank you so much for calling. Because
yes,
I mean, so it's so. One of the first things I talk about with students is like our scope, like what we're thinking about really is like as big as human evolution, because, you know, every single step we take, we were communicating.
Yep. Yeah. And do you find that, you know, at a certain point when studying linguistics, that anthropology, you know, becomes a part of it as well?
Absolutely. So, I was fortunate to have linguistic anthropologists in like all of the departments that I was in, but our, like, it's the study of language, like throughout human history, like is a branch of anthropology. It's like a dedicated thing. That's something I was going to mention earlier, is that like a lot of fields outside of like this most formal, you know, version of linguistics have encountered these questions and have been encountering them for like, all of organized philosophy has asked these questions, right? Like, so it's this thing that is really central to the human experience and all of our like formal developed thought, right?
Yeah. Could you kind of like expound on, you know, terms like Abu Ghida and Abjad?
Wait, what were they?
Abu, how do you say that? Abugida, Abu Ghida or Abu Ghida? It's like scripts, syllabary scripts. Hello?
Yes, I think she's trying to figure out what you're saying.
Yeah. You know how like, for instance, some Eastern languages are written and it looks like it goes from top to bottom?
Yes.
Yeah, the scripts.
Okay, so this is like, it's a type of writing system. So writing systems are really fantastic. Orthography, like how, again, like you were mentioning, we like evolve like a way of representing like a sound inventory in a language and like, or how they combine. So,
and also, kind of gets also back, where does writing begin and art stop?
Exactly. Well, and it also gets back to this idea of like sound patterns being represented in the way the language is on the page, like how the words come together. So in English, like if the English language was like an Abu Ghida, which is also called like a pseudo alphabet or an alpha syllabary, it gives you syllables instead of letters. So like we can start words with things with like B and A, you know, B and I, B and E, right? Like, so those combinations of like two sounds, like ba, bi, be, would be equivalent to a letter. So instead of having the letter B, you'd have like these pairs represented with a symbol of all the sounds you can make. So like, we don't start, like English words with like N, M, you know, like an African name. For example, it might be like Namimbe or something like that, where it's like NM something something. So like if English was a syllabary, it wouldn't have NM in it. Does that make sense? To like explain what it is. So like it's not a single letter. It's really like pairs, but the pairs are like consonant vowel pairs. So it's not just going to be like, yeah, you can have like an oo, like in pool, like P-O-O-L, but those like two O's wouldn't be in the alphabet because it's a consonant and a vowel. So like P-O would be there and O-L would be there, but O-O wouldn't be. And like a segment in the language or whatever. And it would be cool if we had that, because tough, thorough thought though, like all those O-U-G-H's would have a different symbol and you would know exactly how they sound. Like again, like we were talking about in Chinese characters, like they each look a little different, so you'd know exactly how to pronounce them. Like English don't do that. And so yeah, there are the world languages that do like do more work to tell to again like avoid ambiguity.
Well, let me ask you a question. This is one of the things I do want to talk about, the McGurk effect, because, you know, just in relation to everything we've been talking about. And the McGurk effect is basically how you can hear something and know what it is that's being said. And I'm going to play an audio to you. You need the visual, but if you hear someone making a sound that is a B sound, like a ba, 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 but you see someone pronouncing it like someone mouthing a different sound, your brain will reinterpret what it sees literally and hear it differently. And even if I'm telling you this, and you know it, and you watch it, you can't change what your brain is doing. You cannot control how your brain perceives it because of this visual information and how this visual information is influencing how you take in this audio information. And that suggests quite a lot of things. But you said you were aware of the McGurk effect.
Oh, yeah.
So what are your thoughts on it and its impact in language and communication?
So McGurk's pretty cool. It kind of sits at the center of a lot of the theory that I do, that I'm interested in, because it has to do with like how speech is perceived, this like real time, like electrochemical transduction. It really is that of like we get the wave in the ear, then what do we do with it? McGurk like sits at in the middle of that cycle of like, we heard something, now what do we do? We heard something, now what do we do? Okay, so McGurk is interesting because it's about what we call audio-visual integration in the mind. So the eyes are receiving one signal, which is processed faster because the speed of light is faster than the speed of sound. This is actually what underlies this effect, is that light travels faster than sound. So your eyes get the information first and your ears second. And so your brain has to compensate for that because, again, it's trying to give you a seamless experience of now. So because that information does not arrive at the same time, your brain has this operation where audio-visual integration. So I can see and hear something almost at the same time. And you know when this is off. It probably drives you crazy if you're watching a movie or something and the sound's off, or you go to a movie in person and the sound's off, or you're seeing a concert and you're so far back that you can only watch the screen, but you can hear the performer actually singing, but then on the screen, it's not timed right. Okay, so we are very sensitive to audiovisual integration. If something is off, we know it. So the reason why McGurk, okay, we already talked about this too, of like, we're trying to make sense out of something. Ambiguity, our brain does not like that. We're gonna decide, we don't hold anything in a maybe box. We decide what to do with it. Or we immediately seek clarification so we can decide what to do with it. So this is the same thing of like, your brain is forcing a percept. When you hear ba, 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 but you see someone going da, 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 da.
Or fa, 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 fa.
Or fa. Well, actually, they're pairs. They don't all work. So like, it has to be like F and V. And like B and D are pronounced in the same place in the mouth. Their voice and buh-duh, buh-duh.
I'm going to send you a link.
You can send me, but the fa, like, you can't go like ba, fa. Well, you can go ba, fa, but it puts it, it's like a different thing of like, what the baseline McGurk effect is that people hear, when you're trying to make sense of this, if you quote unquote McGurk, because not everybody does it, you get somewhere in between. So you hear neither ba nor pa. You don't hear you don't process what's being spoken visually or orally. Like, you don't get either answer right. Your brain ends up somewhere in the middle. And this matters because, so for what I look at, here's an example. I call you about, you do a job interview with me over the phone. You've only seen my resume. I have a really generic name. It's Kelly Wright. We have a conversation. It goes super well. And then I show up and my visual information does not match what you've been listening to. You did not expect a black girl to walk into your office after hearing my voice.
Trust me, all of a sudden,
oh, we're so sorry. Like, the position has been filled. Like, it's this thing of my visual information did not, like, it's like when somebody comes up to you and they're like, you're so articulate. It's like, you looked at me and you expected me to sound like a hood rat.
And now you're complimenting me
because I don't, sweetheart. Like, what did you expect me to sound like?
I can't
like?
Tell you how many times that's, all right. I can tell you that, you know, you said having my voice is a gift. I can tell you a funny story about having a voice that, like the voice that I have. So I used to have a friend. I used to call him at work, and the secretary would always answer. And she loved my voice, you know. And he'd always answer, oh, my secretary, you know, she's in love with you. So this is back when I used to do science fiction conventions. So he brings her to the science fiction convention, doesn't tell me. So, like, we're at the table, and he's like, you know, Mike, this is so-and-so, you know, the secretary who always, you know. And I'm like, hi. And she's like, wow, so you're Mike Sargent. I'm like, yes, and you're whatever her name was. And she's like, so she's like, you know, look how I pictured you. And I said, well, how did you picture me? She goes, sexier. So, yeah, that sure. Straight. Sure.
No, so here's, so, okay, this is interesting. Sexier. That's rude.
That's what she said.
I'm trying to think of which NPR, like, you know, person it is. Ira Glass. It's Ira Glass.
Okay.
Apparently, people can hear that he's bald.
Yeah, well.
It's interesting because people, like, right, there was this really interesting segment about all these different comments that the anchors get about their voices, and he was like, people write in and say that I sound bald. Which
sound bald,
like, which when you the first time you think about it, you're like, that's not a thing, and then you think about it a little more and you're like, maybe it's a thing. Because, like, I think you probably can hear baldness in the
I think, you know, it's one of those things where you know.
Well, but what's interesting is that means that, like, people have a category for, like, that of, yes, like, what there's, sexy there's men a, sound like, a, what bald men sound like, what tall men sound like.
If there's a cat box, there's a bald man box.
Yeah, so, we talked about stuff we get out of a voice. Like, attractiveness is a decision we make decisions about attractiveness and trustworthiness almost simultaneously. And they affect each other. So, like, I may have made a decision about your trustworthiness, but your hotness could very easily override that. You know?
Well, not according to that secretary, but yes, you're right.
Yeah, and vice versa. Like, you might actually act in a really trustworthy way, but if you're not hot...
Yeah, I saw a meme said that today. It said, like, when an ugly guy starts talking sexually, you want to call the police. So there it is. I know. So
moral of the story, be hot.
Exactly, be hot. All right, so you're still there. Are you still there, sir? There's some other people calling. I want to see. Hello, you're on the air. Who's here?
Yeah, Mike.
Yes. Who's this?
Okay. Kelly just said something very profound. I don't know if you even realized it.
All right.
Our brains do not like ambiguity. Could that be an explanation for why a lot of people have issues with homosexuality? You know, somebody outwardly presenting as a man, but then acting emotionally like a woman and vice versa. What does she think about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So... this idea of, like, my brain have made a decision about this person, like, when you see them walking down the street, about how they're supposed to act or what they sound like, or again, like, if they're attractive or this thing. So this idea of, like, people behaving in a way that doesn't fit what I perceived or what I expected, a lot of that has to do with, like, yeah, there's, like, a discomfort there or, like, a saving face.
And doesn't that have to do, in some cases,
doesn't
that have to do with thousands and thousands of years of reinforcing, you know, what a man's supposed to look and act like and what a woman's supposed to look and act like?
Yeah, essentially. So, I mean, all ideas really work this way.
It's very hard to break. It's very hard for us to break. all of a sudden.
All of a sudden is absolutely the key there. Like, we've seen society change. So we know that it can. And like as a group, we can come to understand things in a different way. But yes, absolutely. It takes a lot of self-work.
Inner work.
Yeah, but it takes inner work, but also a lot of outside forces are influencing just how well you can get to that inner work. I mean,
but it really is, because it's neurons. You know, it really is like neurons that fire together, wire together. That somewhere in our brain, we're making that connection of being like, I want to put this in another box, or I need two boxes. I have to peel trucks off of fire trucks. It's that thing of like, you kind of have to want to, and then, you know.
Yep. All right. Thanks, Kelly. Love you.
Love you. Thank you for calling.
All right. The phone number here is 212-209-2877. And we're here with Dr. Kelly Love. No, with Dr. Kelly Wright, who is, among other things, a raciolinguist. And we've been talking about words and their effect. And I did want to break down, since we've been talking so much about language, I put here some basic criteria for a system. What is the criteria for a system of communication to be considered in a language? Now, I have these five criteria that I looked up to or culled together, but I want to know if you have one that you would give based on who and what you are. Like, what the basic criteria for a system of communication to be considered a language, considering there are over 6,000.
So thousands of languages, you know, 700 plus essentially operating right now. Like in the world's users. So there's a bit of a political, like, we can maybe read this list.
Okay.
But there's a bit of a political distinction, in my opinion, underneath this. So like, language with a lowercase L, right, is essentially that like anything anyone's doing to communicate, whatever that is. That could be an art. That could be a temper tantrum, right?
An essay,
anything from the most formal to the most informal that you can imagine. Like, to me, all of that counts as language. Maybe sometimes just like moving an eyebrow, right? Like this kind of stuff, right? But language with a capital L, is really administrative. Right? It has to do with like how things are being operated, what your landscape is like that kind of thing of like, is it represented outside of your own personal experience or like your family usage? That's how, like, what's the difference between a joke and an inside joke? You know, it's like, that is like the difference between like lowercase L language and capital L language, maybe. And it's a porous barrier. Right? It's not a hard line.
Okay. All right. Well, all right. I'm just going to read. I won't go into all of it, but these 5 points, because there are a lot of things that can be considered, like you said, a language, lowercase L. So one is structure and grammar. So that's the rules and patterns governing the arrangement of words, phrases, and sentences. So grammatical structure that help convey meaning and enable communication. Then vocabulary. All right. So language has lexicons and vocabulary specific to that language and blah, blah, blah. That all makes sense. Productivity. Now, that's what I think is interesting. Languages, it says, are generative, meaning that speakers can create and understand novel utterances they have never encountered before. This creative aspect allows for the expression of new ideas and thoughts. Now, would you have always considered productivity a component of something to be considered a language?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because... yeah, productivity just means you use it, kind of, or that it's like understood that you use it and it could be understood. Cause yeah, it is this idea of, I think Chomsky's example is, you know, colorless green ideas sleep furiously.
Right.
Like this sentence of like, okay,
right.
This isn't really how we use any of those words, but you could start to assign meaning to it. Like, that's productivity in that, like, I don't have to have heard these words in this order to know exactly what is happening here.
Okay.
And branding really works on that too, of like, you hear like the name of a company like Waze,
right.
And you're like, okay, I know what Waze is for.
Or you hear a phrase like a long time ago. All right, far, far away. Okay, all right. Then communicative intent. It says languages are used to convey meaning and communicate ideas, whether they're factual, expressive, or social in nature. They enable speakers to exchange information, express their thoughts and emotions. So communicative intent, do you agree with that as a basic criteria?
Let's say yes.
All right. Then the last one is cultural and social context. Languages are embedded within specific cultures and communities. They often reflect the values, customs, and identities of a particular group of people. Now, this is true. And it says, now, while the criteria above provides a general framework, it's important to note that language is a dynamic and evolving system. So the question I have here is, Klingon is a language. And it fits all five of these categories. And is it a language because it fits all those categories? Or in spite of? Or just it had to be these things to be considered actual language versus a series of phrases in a TV series?
Yeah, this is a good question. Okay, so there's maybe a better thing to ask is, like, when did Klingon become a language?
Right,
because
okay, yes.
We know that it wasn't fully built out when the show started.
No, I know.
So it's very interesting to think about the types of sounds, patterns, etc., that were initially used to represent this community. Because the community and the idea of, like, what a Klingon culture was existed before the language. So this language, you know, is like guttural and like very, you know, aggressive. And it has like these deeper, harder sounds in it.
Right. And these warrior values. Yes.
Right. That like is supposed to, or maybe, and supposed to is a big, strong word, because like, even though this language was created, it's called a created language, and there are many, that does not necessarily mean that all of it, the choices that were made were deliberate, in that, like, again, like the sound symbolism is present. Like, there are a lot of things in the structure of Klingon that are perhaps incidental and reflect like our language ideologies. Now, the question again is, like, maybe when did it become a language? Because, and productivity is a big part of that, is like, when did people start to use it? Because another point that was made like earlier is that, you know, writing, you know, is this thing where a bunch of language, most of the world's languages were oral until like the missionaries came along and gave them grammars, and then they started writing. A lot of those indigenous communities look at the written forms of their languages and say, like, this doesn't represent our culture. It's like not reflective of us. It is not productive. The quote unquote language is not productive, the written form, because they don't use it, right? It's not actually actively employed by people. This is another thing about, and this is like where in all of these like five aspects, different linguists are going to agree and disagree, because we've talked before here about language death. So for me, like, what does it mean for a language to disappear or be gone? For me, it means that we don't even know anything about it. Like, I can't tell you anything about the culture that this language like arose from, because like, I can list to you hundreds of languages that aren't used anymore, that we don't have any written records for. But I can still list them to you. So they're not dead.
Well, but here's my question. So then, okay, how can a dead language still be a language? If part of the criteria to be considered a language of these things about usage, how can a dead language be a language?
So this is, a question, because again, like, so for example, if people say Latin all the time, like, Latin's an example of a dead language. Like, that's like the first one that everybody points to.
Right.
We use Latin all the time. It's not dead. Look at the medical profession. Get back to me. Like, look at religion and get back to me. Like, we're using Latin. We look at plants classification and get back to me. Like, we are using Latin. It is being it is productive. It is still influencing the ways in which new English words are formed. So, and not only English words, okay? Like romance languages.
So what
That's
is,
not
what,
death.
No, it's not death, but what's the difference between a language that gives birth to other languages versus a language that's been cannibalized into other languages?
Okay, so again, like, it's a functional question. Like, it's a political question. Like, what is the difference between a progenitor, you know, and... Like, we talk about, like, superstrate versus substrate. Like, when an island is colonized and it already has multiple indigenous languages that existed in a social hierarchy to begin with, like, there was already workers and rulers there. Those people's languages were not the same. And so then, like, Dutch comes and throws itself on top of all of that stuff that was already going on. And when that language, like, mixes into something new... over generation, they talk about it as a Dutch language, but why?
Like all the roads and parks and towns that have Native American names around this country.
It's this thing of like, it really has to do with like this political distinction, because like, and the why is that everybody who like Creolistics, like the discipline, like started measuring it that way. So you know, like when we were talking before about like authority, like this forms, or like writing, you know, like speech being superior to writing. Like, that just has to do with like your frame of reference and like who, like where, like what disciplinary assumptions you start with. So yeah, this idea of like structure and grammar is maybe like one to pick at, because enabling communication is maybe like the most important thing there. Like for a linguist, a grammar is what is in your head, is what allows the language to function. It's the rules by which like you get sentences out. Not really, it's more about production than it is perception, right? And the structure is like that sentence that comes out. Like you have a set of rules that tells you what to produce, and then you have what you produce. And sometimes there's some black box in between there, right? So that's maybe like what we're looking for, is like evidence of this black boxiness, more thinking about it like physiologically, of there is some, we can like trace this back to roots, but there's this big gap in between. We don't actually like know how like cognition operates, right? But we do know like there's like this systematic processing and reprocessing of information. That's, you know, what we're looking at. So sign languages, like babies make their own like home signs, or like twins, you know, have their own language between twins. It's like this kind of thing of like, is that a language? Because it's doing all of these things. It just only maybe does them for a certain period of the lifespan, or only in one given context. Like again, like an inside joke, like you and your best friend have like a shorthand, or can sit around and talk about stuff, or you can just look at them across the room and they already know everything that you're thinking. Like, is that a language? But that's, yeah. So I guess like, this is what I mean about like, it's an academic. Again, like we're talking about lines all night tonight. Where do you draw the line?
This is true. I used to have a language with a friend of mine. We used to have a language that we could speak and no one else could understand it but us.
I love that. And that to me is just as real as these other things.
Yes, well, he's no longer with us, so it's a dead language because no one else speaks it but me.
No.
So, well, you're tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI 99.5 FM, and on the web at WBAI.org. We've been here with Dr. Kelly Wright, who is our resident linguist and scholar and professor of love. So, because you had so much love tonight. So,
okay.
How can people follow you and what you do? Because I know they can just put your name in, but like you said, it is a common name that could be misspelled, because there's Wright and then there's Wright.
And Kelly. We'll accept any number of vowels at the end. It's K-E-L-L-E-I-G-H. No.
Kelly. Kelly-A.
I am easily Googleable, despite the, you know, generic nature of my name. Kelly Wright Linguistics will get you there. I am also on Instagram at Betty Machete, E-T-T-E, Machete, Etty. yeah, and I'm really easy to find. Please email me. Please DM, reach out. Yeah, I'm bookable.
Bookable. And you're also Googleable.
Very easily Googleable.
Very easily Googleable. And now, I had a closing story, a brief story that I thought was fun of something that a kid believed. But I want to know if you had any closing things you wanted to say.
Now I want to hear the story.
All right, here's one. It says, and this is you know, where people say, so what's something you misunderstood as a kid that you understand better now? It says, I believe dead ends were where everyone in the neighborhood went that died. I would avoid the area at all costs because I wasn't sure what would cause them all to die, and I didn't want to be next. Then one day, my mom gave a friend of mine a ride home, and she lived in a dead end. And I thought, wow, my God, she hasn't died yet. Maybe she doesn't know. Should I warn her? Then I asked her if she was scared about dying. I remember the awkward silence as they tried to figure out what the heck I was talking about. About a week later, I couldn't hold it in anymore, but I didn't want to say something to scare her, so I asked her how her neighbors died. She was like, what? My neighbors aren't dead. And then I explained what I knew about dead ends, and she laughed and then went on to tell everyone about it. Everyone was walking around acting like zombies on recess, making fun of me. So there it is.
This is the best. I love this.
And then, okay, there's one more to the same person. She thought that this is, again, this reminds me of like what the other male caller said about watching movies. Said, I thought that if you touched a thorn from a rose, it would grow into your arm and poke you in the heart, and you would die of a broken heart. That's a pretty good imagination there, I think.
Yeah, it is. So, I know.
So, I love the dead end story. I just thought, like, dead end is where people go to die. I mean, it's dead end.
It kind of makes sense.
It does. I could just see, like, yeah, that's. I don't want to go down the dead end because I don't know what happens. So, we're here on Mondays from 10 p.m. till midnight. And, well, I've really enjoyed our conversation here, Kelly. I hope you've
Me too. This was lovely. Yeah, let us know what you want us to talk about next time.
Oh, yeah. Well, I will definitely have more of a advanced conversation. So, until next time, this has been Night Shift. I'm Mike Sargent. And if you've enjoyed the show, please consider making a pledge in the name of Night Shift. You can call right now if you want to make a pledge, 212-209-2950, and make a $30 pledge in the name of Night Shift. Go ahead. Did you have a party word there? What were you going to say?
I said dollar a day. Make that donation.
That's right. Dollar a day. There it is.